All right, I think we got most of the folks who are going to get started. We'll let other people wander in. So my name is Bob Taylor. I'm a principal consultant and premier developer for Microsoft. I've been involved in the certification game since 93 on NT3.1. That's where I started my certification. I've developed SQL 2000, 2005 exams, all the .NET exams back when it was the analyzing requirements, defining solution architectures. I've taken over 50 exams. I hold the MCA, the MCM, MCSM, MCSE, all the letters there. So I've been, like I said, I'm passionate about certification. I've written books, the training kit for this course. In fact, I was the technical editor for it. Just means I'm old. I've been around a long time. So, all right. For those of you who just came in, we're going to go through some of the canned slides that Microsoft Certification has asked us to cover. What's in it for you? You get more exposure to the products, and to me, that's the primary benefit of becoming certified, is that you have to study parts of the product that you don't use in your day-to-day business, you know, day-to-day work, and it gives you that broader experience with the SQL Server product. It gives you better knowledge, and then, you know, this is where, you know, annual review time, you know, oh, I'm educating my coworkers because I'm certified. Again, I'm going to leave that up. I'm not going to spend a lot of time reading it, but these are some of the goals that the Microsoft certification team feels that you get from being certified for your career. For those of you who have taken certification exams over the years, the early days, it was different. You could get questions that had answers that didn't exist, weren't syntactically correct. We've really increased the rigor, trying to make the questions more real world. In fact, every answer, every distractor and answer must be achievable. In other words, if there's Transact SQL code, it must run. It just doesn't accomplish the goal that you've been set out to fix. So to do this, we've now gone through, we're doing this recertification process. I'm going to show you the certification path. The first level is called MCSA, Solution Associate, and it's three exams. The exam that you're studying for right now is one of those three exams. And that's version specific, so SQL Server 2012. The MCSE data platform is a version non-specific certification. So all you have to do to keep your data platform MCSE current is, as if we have recertification exams, like a year or two down the road, you would have to pass that, and that keeps your major certification kind of current. We heard a lot of feedback from hiring managers that this guy has got 14 or 15 different certifications, because each time we change the name, it's a new certification. So now we're saying, for data platform, I've been certified since 2011, for example. And so it kind of simplifies it in the industry. They understand what that certification means. So it's more relevant. There's a wide variety. Obviously, we're focusing here, the MCSE. The three exams that you take for the MCSA are fundamental, whether you're going business intelligence or data platform. What happens is you take two additional exams on top of those three to reach the other certifications, and I'll show you what they are in a second. All right. We're trying to make this more real world, less memorized, come in and take a multiple choice exam. We're trying to get you to think about the solutions. What are, you know, you have disparate business requirements, and how do they all fit together to drive you to a goal? And we'll talk about how the questions are laid out in just a second. We're moving more and more to the case study model, where you will get it's a UI that has a bunch of buttons on the left, and you say business requirements, technical requirements, security, user interface, reporting, marketing, whatever it makes sense for that business case. As you click on it, you get the requirements for that section. Those are used for a series of 8 to 10 questions. So that you read all that material once, and then you apply it for 8 to 10 questions. and it's designed to make you synthesize your answer from different bits and pieces of information, as opposed to just saying, I need point-in-time recovery. Do I use bulk log, simple, or full? Right? I mean, that's kind of more of a memorization thing. So this is designed to make it more real-world. Also, we're adding some new item types. If you haven't taken the test in a while, you may see some of them. There's a build list and reorder. So we give you a list of 12 steps. Maybe you need 6. Maybe you need 5. You have to figure out which ones you need. You drag them over to the other column and put them in the correct order that you would have to perform the steps. So the scenario may say I do nightly backs on Sunday. I do differentials on Wednesday. Thursday night at 10, I had a server crash and I need to restore. What do I do? And you put them in the correct order. Yes. Still zero. Yeah, every question is 1 point, and there's no partial credit, unfortunately. That's just the way they've done it. Part of it is because of the grading of the exams. The exam engine that does the grading can't handle the partial credit. So it's when you build an item, you actually have to give it the list of items that comprise the correct answer, and if it doesn't match that, you're out of luck. All right. Most of the exams are between 40 and 60 questions, from 1 to 4 hours long. Just depends on which exam it is. If it's not a case study, you can review questions, move around, come back to them. Thing to note is case studies. Yeah, it's up there. Case studies, you can't go back. Once you've completed a case study, the testing engine is designed such that, good or bad, when that case study's done, you can't go back to it. You can still go back and move around the extra questions, because normally on a case study exam you'll have 2 or 3 case studies and then you'll have 30 or 40 traditional items, either multiple choice or whatever. 700 is a passing score on all of our exams, but it doesn't mean 70%. We were having this discussion earlier. What happens is after the exam's been in beta and we see how the people that have already certified PAT have been working with that exam, we decide what is the minimal qualified candidate need to know to be certified. And if it's 70 questions and that happens to be 52 right, then 52 now equates to that 700 score. So that's why when you look at your score sheets from Prometric, you know, it'll say, well, did I miss by 1? Did I miss by 3? There's no way I can figure out the percentage. But it's really just, it's a level mark, 700's the pass, and it's based on what it means to be a minimally qualified candidate for that exam. Again, that's the cut score I was just talking about, no partial credits. The key, though, if you're close, it's not like the SAT. We don't deduct points for wrong answers. So if you get to a question and you know 2 of the answers are absolutely wrong and you're struggling to decide between the 2, it doesn't hurt you to choose one of them. Don't leave it blank. Make a choice. 50-50 chance you're going to get the points. It is what it is, but that's how it plays. All the questions have a similar anatomy, regardless of whether they're a case study or they're the standalone item types. You have a set of questions. You know, I am a DBA for Contoso or Fabricam, whatever, and I am installing SQL Server 2012, and I have this kind of box, and it's this OS for the box, and it has this much memory. And then there's a goal statement. What should I do? Which edition of SQL Server should I install? What recovery model should I use? It's always a what. So there's a single statement, and that's the goal, and that's the purpose of the question. The rest is amplifying information to help you make that decision. But if you look at that goal statement and that makes sense to you, you can quickly look at the business goal up front, and it should telegraph you the answer. You should be able to know what the answer is and then look down to the answer choices and find it. Again, we're not trying to trick you. So again, there's 2 types of questions. There's single choice, which are radio buttons, which makes it very obvious. I can only choose one. Then there's the multiple, where you can choose. It may say choose all that apply or choose three in order to satisfy the goals of the statement. Generally, we try to stay away from the, you know, choose all that apply, because it doesn't really tell us a whole lot. But you will still see them. Some writers, item writers, think it, you know, they're trying to make their questions hard, and they add that, and it gets through editing. So unless there's something really specific about having to know all the items and know that none of the other items are applicable, and we don't want to give you a clue as to how many of those items are, then that's where choose all that applies. So there's very limited application, in my opinion. So the distractors all have to be performable, but just not accomplish the goal. So if it's Transact SQL, there shouldn't be any syntax errors. It should be something that would run if you had it in Management Studio. If it can't say, you know, SP underscore Bob's Cool Store procedure, because that doesn't exist in the product. So it all has to be something that either exists in the product or will execute in the product and just does not accomplish the goal statement. So that's the key. Again, a lot of people will argue this. We really don't try to trick you. The idea is that we want the qualified candidate to pass the exam. And if I have a qualified candidate and I throw in one question that's tricky, and now they didn't make the cut score, it does nothing, one, for the value of the certification, and it doesn't help that individual either. So the goal is really, if you're qualified, you should be able to breeze through the exam pretty quickly. Like I said, the question should telegraph the correct answer. If you read the business requirements and the goal statement, you should almost be able to hold your hand over the answers and say, full recovery model, C. So you should know the answers in advance. That's the goal anyway. All right, we done with these now? Yes. So again, I'll run through these quickly. The three exams that you need for your MCSA are 461, 62, and 63. We did the prep for 461 this morning. We're doing 462 now. There is no prep session right now for 463. 463 are basics of, you know, installing integration services, configuring analysis services. It's not real deep, but it focuses on more of the data warehousing side of the product. Once you have that, that's the MCSA. Then by adding the 464 and 465, you would get the MCSE data platform. So this is the one, as you notice, there's no version here, so it doesn't expire. You just recertify by showing that you have current knowledge on the product. There's a 466 and 7 if you want to do the business intelligence. One is AS and RS, and the other is, I think it's more the tabular model and things like that. It's been a while since I took those. Yes, sir? Yes, you have, I think once they've released the recertification exam, you have a 12-month period in which to take it. If you don't, then your MCSE will become inactive. And in order to reactivate it, you would have to go through the full process of the MCSA plus the two extra exams. So highly recommend, once you get your MCSE, it's going to be a smaller exam, because it's really going to be the delta. In this case, SQL 2014 questions are being seeded into the 2012 because they didn't feel it justified a brand new exam and rebranding of the MCSA. So probably the next major version, 2016 or whatever it might be, will be when the recertification period starts. Oh, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. All right. Has everyone here been to the learning page for 462? So www.microsoft.com/learning. Look up 7462. That's what that link is. So when you download the deck and all, after the session is over, when you get home, you can just click on it. It will show you the functional groups, which are the high-level objectives for the exam. And then when you click the plus sign, it'll show you a bulleted list of the types of topics that will be examined under that functional group. The functional group is what determines the weighting the relative weight of the different areas of the exam. And there's links to get more information. So if we have prep exam, prep videos, training kits, instructor-led training, that's all listed on that page. So it's a great resource. I like to print it out and then go through and highlight the ones that I know, and that lets me know where I got to spend my time studying. So this is the list of the functional areas. This is the breakdown. So if you take the exam, 19% of the questions on the exam will equate to installing and configuring SQL Server. Okay, and again, this is all up on the MS Learning site. There's also a very cool Windows 8.1 app in the store. Just type in MCSA, and there's a Windows 8 app that has all the roadmap and all the details about the exams on it. It's very cool. All right, we're going to go into these. We have a lot to go through. So we'll start right at the beginning with installing and configure SQL Server. Things that you need to know. The physical architecture of storage is an important topic. So knowing that you don't want to have your data files on the same drive as your log files, that you don't want tempdb on the same drive as your data files. You don't want to put your data files on the system drive or the SQL binary drive, things like that. Configuring tempdb, understanding when there's contention in tempdb, and you may want to have multiple files backing your tempdb. Understand the difference, why file groups exist, what you can use them for. So things like VLDB, where you have a read-only file group that you back up once a quarter, and all your read-only data is there. You also don't get locks. So that understand the implication of partitioning and having data on multiple file groups. Understand the configuration of file stream and file table. If I were to hedge my bets, probably less questions on file stream and file table. So within that 19%, we have all these other objectives, and some of those are weighted more heavily than others. There are multiple forms of each exam, so it's a pseudo-random generation. So when you sit down to take the exam for a given objective, if there were 8 items and we said you need to have 3, we'll randomly pick 3. So you could sit the exam right afterwards and get different questions for that objective. So if it's a lower percentage overall, the chances are you're either going to get the same question or it may not even show up on a given form. Okay. Be comfortable with using core mode installation. How many people have used SQL Server core installation? Anybody? One. Okay. It's an area that gets most people. Core just says we're loading up the Windows operating system with no GUI. And you have to do command line switches, you have to use PowerShell, and that's an area that most people struggle with if they haven't done it. If you have not been there, Microsoft.com/SQL Server Learning Center has a whole variety of hands-on labs where you can spin these up in the cloud. Doesn't cost you anything. You can go in and do a server core installation in a VM, and it's available for free up on the Learning Center. Highly recommend you do that. Additionally, if you still have time today, there are some hands-on labs downstairs too as well. They are. Okay. Oh, great. Okay. I did not know that. Thank you. So did you hear that? For 6 months after Tech Ed, the hands-on labs are also available there. So excellent. You'll get some questions about benchmarking. The benchmarking they're talking about is the disk I/O subsystem generally. There are two tools. Interestingly, they both start with SQL. And they're really not SQL specific. The SQL I/O sim sort of is. SQL I/O is really just a way to benchmark the IOs per second, or IOPS, that your storage device can handle. You do it before you install SQL Server, you don't have anything else running, and you say, here's my read-write pattern, I'm 60% writes and 40% reads and this kind of volume, and it emulates that, and you can measure the IOs per second. SQL IO Sim is very similar. It was a later tool that came out. but it tries to more closely emulate a SQL Server set of patterns without SQL Server being in place. So when you're trying to decide what the raw performance of your storage medium is, use SQLio. And if you want to look at SQL Server type workloads, the SQLio SIM. Installing SSIS, can you click a checkbox? You can. So it's installed, but you have to, you know, talk about the service accounts and those kinds of things. So SSRS and SSAS are in the 463 exam, so you don't have to worry about them. Know how to go through using either control panel installed programs or the SQL setup and go back and either enable or disable or add features to your installation. So let's say you've installed a basic SQL Server instance, and now suddenly your boss says, hey, we need integration services. How do I go back and rerun the setup to add those new features? And again, the UI, if you've done that install, it's pretty straightforward. At any time, if you've got questions, I know we got a lot of material and I'm chunking along, but I'm happy to entertain questions. And like I said, well, most of you weren't here, but there's no session after this one. So if we run long, I'm more than happy to stay and help. So when you're doing a core installation, everything is command line based. So setup slash, and these are the slashes that you're most likely to need when you're doing your basic core. SQL Engine is the core. If you're doing replication, personally, I would do the core installation of the engine, and then I would use Management Studio to or rerun there is a switch that will turn the GUI on, a limited GUI, and then you can use the GUI to do the replication installation. But if you want to do it from command line, it's certainly possible. All of the command line options, you can run setup with slash Q, I think it's QB, and do an intended install, and it will write the response file so you can see what all these switches are. And then you can use that for multiple. So you install it once using the GUI, and then use that response file to, you know, stamp out SQL instances as many as you need. Okay, so just know what the different ones are. ASIS, I mean, they're pretty straightforward. They're kind of self-explanatory. But you will see some questions on the switches for core installation. Think about core installation is you do have to enable TCP/IP using some of the PowerShell scripts, open firewall holes so that you can communicate it. But once you have the core installation installed, you can then go to another box where you have SQL Server Management Studio installed and connect to it just like it was any other instance, and then use your GUI tools to go ahead and manage that rather than trying to do everything from PowerShell and the command line. They've greatly enhanced the PowerShell commandlets, so you can do pretty much anything you need to do with PowerShell if you want to learn all the switches and dashes and verbs and all that kind of stuff. All right. So here's where you can go in if you want to go back and add SQL Server. You can right-click and it'll say change. Yes, sir? Correct. No, the reporting services cannot be installed on a core. It has UI elements that have to be available. So if we're going to, the question was, can you install reporting services on a core installation? There are GUI, there are UI elements that are required for the reporting services installation that are not supported under core. Here, this is an old slide. So it says 2012 RC0, right click, change. It brings up the setup, and then it's add or change features, to add or change features. Pretty easy. SQLio, again, it's a command-based tool. It was written in the early days by the SQL product group. And like I said, it really doesn't have anything to do with SQL. It's really an IO test rig. If you go out to TechNet and search for SQLio, they have a very comprehensive set of documentation that tells you how to specify the read and the write patterns, what your block size is, whether you know logs are on this drive and whatever. So it'll do sequential I/O on log drives, random read and write on other drives that you've set up for data files, and it'll give you the composite performance for your drives raw without SQL ever being installed. So what does that do for you? Well, if you say, okay, this system can handle 1,500 IOs per second, you know you're never going to get any better than that with SQL Server. So if you're then install SQL Server, you're running your application, and you're seeing 800 IOPS, you know either SQL's misconfigured or something's gone different with the SAN, but you have a way to say, I know what the maximum is, and that's a goal that you can shoot for when you're doing your tuning and optimizations. One of the key things as a DBA, obviously, is keeping your database online and being able to recover it in case of a disaster. So this is a key area. I don't have the percentage, but this was a higher percentage. You're wanting to be able to do backup and restore, know how to attach and detach, and we're going to drill into these. Understand the different recovery models, the difference between simple, bulk logged, and full, what that buys you and what that prevents you from doing when you use the different models, when you might use them, and operations that you may have to take. Let's say we're loading an ETL for a data warehouse, large bunch of data. We don't really want to log all the inserts to the transaction log. So we go to bulk logged model. Now all we allocate, all we log are the extent allocations. We don't log all the individual inserts. But that gives you a window where you're susceptible to data loss. So as soon as you're done with that load, switch back to full and take a full backup, and that way you're covered up to your point in time. So that's just different strategies. We'll go through them. No, we won't. I guess I don't have any more detail. Transferring logins from one SQL Server to another, there's SP change login, which still exists. Normally, what we recommend is scripting the objects in one database and then replaying them in the other. With the inclusion of the partially contained databases, which were introduced in 2012, you can now have login-less users. So the traditional model in SQL Server is somebody logs into SQL Server, they're authenticated, and then when they access a database, they have to have a user provisioned in that database to give them authorization in that database. In the new partially contained model, you can have users that log in directly to a database without doing a login at the server level. So that's something that you need to know. The beauty of that is when I back up that database and restore it somewhere else, all those users' logins, the user objects, go with that database. And that's why it's called, the goal eventually is to have a fully contained database where the, what do they call it? DAC. I can't remember what that three-letter acronym means, but it's basically the ability to take your database application and move it. Right now, MSDB jobs, SQL agent jobs, those kinds of things don't move, just the logins. So it's something to know about the security. You'll want to know when to upgrade, when to migrate. So they'll give you questions like, we have this, we have a SQL Server 2008 R2 instance. It's got to be up, you know, five nines, and, you know, we can't afford any downtime. So give you some more information, and then they say, you know, what should you do? And the answer is, do you migrate in place? Which means you're taking the system down and trying to migrate it in place. And if you migrate it in place or update it in place, there's no fallback. Because once the binaries are there, the binaries are there. So maybe in that case, you spin up a separate box, you do the upgrade, the installation there, then attach and detach your database and install it on the other server and switch the connection string. So you just need to, those are some of the scenario-based questions that you're going to run into. They're going to ask you to look at the business requirements and decide, should we do an in-place or an update? In some cases, let's see, migrate. at this point in time, the migration, there really aren't any showstoppers. When we went from 2000 to 2005, there were a lot of cases where people couldn't do the direct upgrade path because they had the old outer join syntax, and you know it just wouldn't work in that compatibility level. So again, that's an area to study, upgrades and migrations. Just be familiar with the purpose of each of the different functions. There's no real deep questions on the full text, on the analysis service and reporting services. For full text, be sure you understand the fact that in the later versions of SQL Server, the catalogs and indexes are part of your database, as opposed to the old version, where the indexes and catalogs were separate objects out on disk, and it was a management nightmare to keep them backed up and in sync with your database. They're now in the database, and that's something to know. You may or may not, it was very lightly weighted. There's a feature that most people don't know about called semantic search. Has anyone heard of that? So it's kind of like full text search on steroids. It gives you semantic linkage. So you can do a search for, SQL Server, and it will pull up documents that have SQL Server, have Oracle. It understands the semantics of the words that you're doing. And it's another indexing where it goes through and it builds these inferences and relationships. I from the people that I've talked to that have taken the exam, and when I took it way back when, I didn't get a semantic search. So it kind of falls in the full text. Just understand that they're part of the database now. They're backed up and restored as part of the database. File stream and file table, really, just know that if you don't enable it during installation, that you can go to SQL Server Configuration Manager, right-click on the SQL Server instance service, and there's a file stream tab where you click and you give it a share name. So that has to be done before you can actually create any file stream or file share file groups. If you don't, you'll get an error when you try to do it. You'll go, oh, I got to go back to Configuration Manager and enable it. So, oh, here we go, semantic search. Again, if it were me and I was focusing on the exam and what I was worrying about, I would not necessarily focus on this, but just know there are Office 2010, and I believe there's a 2013 that's in beta right now. They're filter packs, so they understand DocX, XLSX, PPTX. It understands the Office file format so that it can do the semantic harvesting. You have to enable them. And then there's a separate MSI that's in the tools installation folder that you run to enable this. Again, would I spend a lot of time studying it? If you miss that one, you miss that. That's my opinion. Most people in the industry are not using it. So, SQL Server Agent. Understand the differences between automatic, manual, what the SQL Server Agent is used for internally, things like maintenance plans, for replication, all the different functions. If you're using the management data warehouse, the data collector uses SQL Agent jobs. So just understand how to configure that, how to monitor it, how to look at the history, how to, there's no simulation type where you're going to click and get a log view or anything, but it may say you in your SQL Agent log, you saw this error. How would you troubleshoot that? So, yes? Did I? Oh, Integration Services Security. Okay, so one of the things that was introduced in 2012 for Integration Services is the ability to have your catalog on SQL Server. And because of that, you have to apply security to the SSISDB database. And so you can have different classes of users. You can have administrative users. You can have users, somebody operators that run it. And just know that there are different security settings for access to the SSISDB database. The SSISDB database allows you to do things like have multiple environments. So has anybody here worked with SSIS in the past? Okay, good. So the configurations, you know how much of a pain it was to move from server to server. In 2012, we've given you the ability to create environments. So you'll have a production environment, a QA environment, a dev environment under the project in SSISDB. And you can just say, for this environment, use this configuration. So when I say, I want to run this package in QA, it automatically knows from the configuration that for that environment that the QA server is Bob's SQL server or whatever. But in order to have operators and administrators, you do have to set the security for integration services. Thank you. I missed that one. You're not going to... So to create statements when you're talking about these types of exams, in the master's exams, the one that I used to administer, create was absolutely possible because we gave you a VM and you had to do the work and then we looked at the end product. Here, create is understand how you would create it. We're not going to actually ask you to go in and create alerts or operators. But things like creating an alert on an 824 hardware error, you know, how would you do that? What would you do? Would you send a pager? Does anybody have pagers anymore? Or an email or a text or something like that. So just understand the process of using the create, alert, and operator.
So what are the examples?
You are a DBA for Contoso something or other. And you've been noticing intermittent checksum errors on pages in your database. You need to be alerted when there is a problem. What should you do? Create an alert on the 824 or on a certain severity level. And it'll be, I mean, like for that one, it'll be pretty specific. Just, there's, if you go into the management studio and you go into the alerts, there's a drop-down box. It's maybe 18, and those are the common ones, and most of those aren't all that common. 823 and 824 are hardware related to I/O. There's one for corruption, when we detect corruption. So that you, there's only a handful in there that you really want to make sure you have alerts up and running and that somebody gets notified as soon as it happens. So it'll be that kind of situation where they'll give you a scenario, and the solution is to create an alert. So, there we go. Blah, blah, blah. This is a long one, and I apologize. So I'm going to, they required me to have certain font sizes. Server, blah, 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 blah. SAN, iSCSI. You want to install it, the I/O requirements will reach over 2,000 megabytes per second. Okay. You need to determine if server 1 and SAN 1 can handle the requirements. Now, has this just telegraphed something to you based on things that we've said? Exactly. And that's what a well-written test question should do. If you're qualified, you understand the material, you shouldn't even have to see the answers to know what the answer would be. And again, these are just tips. It has to exist in the current or prior version, and it has to work. So in this case, it was SQL I/O. All right, maintaining instances and databases. Be cognizant of why you would want to have multiple file groups. Unfortunately, the exam doesn't test the best practice that none of your user objects should be on your primary file group, which I wish more people would do, because you can bring your database up a lot quicker. But understand why you might have multiple file groups. So what I was just alluding to is, by default, the default file group is the primary file group that's created when you first install your SQL Server instance and you create your database. The best practice is create a new file group that all of your user objects are created in. The reason being is, if you have the primary file group that just has the system tables and the metadata information, if you ever have to restore that database, you can restore that file group first, The database is up and operational, and then you can restore the other file groups with the user objects after the fact. So that's a best practice, not necessarily tested in the exam. The other another reason you might use multiple file groups, if you have a large amount of historical data. A lot of systems are having 10 years of historical data that's not going to change. You can put that in a read-only file group. Maybe you do a quarterly data migration to it. Put it in a read-only file group. You only have to back that up periodically. You don't have to back it up every night. So it gives you better management of the very large databases. Also, the fact that it's read-only, we don't take locks when we're accessing data in the historical data, which is going to give you better performance. Understand the difference between simple, bulk logged, and full. So simple is the model that's used in TempDB. Essentially, everything, as soon as it gets committed, gets checkpointed and is gone. It's very easy to use, but you get no point-in-time recovery. The other end of the spectrum, the full recovery model, every operation is written to the log and hardened before that operation is allowed to complete in the engine. So this will give you the best potential for a point-in-time recovery in case of a disaster. One thing to note is if you are doing the full recovery model and your system crashes, the database is non-accessible, in most cases you can go in and back up what's known as the tail of the log. And that's important to get you back to the last point in time. So you have your periodic transaction log backups, which keep the log from growing exponentially. But always, when you have a disaster, go in and take the tail of the log backup. And in some cases, the UI will prompt you to do that before you're allowed to do anything else, so that you can get the very last transactions before the system crashes. We already kind of talked about the partially contained databases. The users are provisioned in the database and do not require a login at the instance level. Data compression. Understand the various options for compression. So you have none. You have row compression, which essentially takes every data type and makes it a var data type. So if I have a big int, which is 8 bytes, and I'm storing the value 0 in it, when I do row compression, I now compress that down to a single byte and store that 0 in a single byte versus 8. So every data type essentially becomes var. This grew out of the var decimal that we introduced in 2008 R2 for SAP, and then they just kind of took it further. The other option is page compression. It requires more CPU utilization, but gets you much better compression numbers. In most cases, you'll find that CPU is a 3 to 4% hit for compression, but the improvement in your disk I/O, because you're pulling more data per read, is more than outweighs it. Also, the pages remain compressed in the buffer pool, so you use your memory more effectively. We only decompress a row when we actually have to modify it or present it back to the client. Again, so just understand the differences between the row compression and page compression. Is where they're not going to ask you to, you know, about SP estimate, storage savings, internal stored procedure to estimate how much compression you're going to get. If you're interested in that, go to CodePlex, SQL Server Compression Estimator. Is a project I wrote. Feel free to download it. It'll examine an entire database and recommend compression for you. Let me know how you like it. So transparent data encryption. This one you will see some questions on. And some of the questions you'll see will be build list and reorder. And I have a slide on TDE here in a second. So you definitely want to be comfortable with the transparent data encryption. Transparent data encryption essentially encrypts at the data file level. The overhead is minimal, and it's transparent. If somebody takes and detaches the database and tries to attach it to another server without having the certificate and the master key, they can't do it. Likewise, if it's encrypted, the backup can't be restored without the service master key, the master key, and the certificate. So it's a way to protect your data at rest. Just like any other system, however, when it's in the buffer pool, it's unencrypted. So there's always that one little window where if you really don't trust your DBA, then you're out of luck. So for data encryption, so yeah, go ahead and get a picture of this one. Build list and reorder. This is a perfect example of where you're going to see a build list and reorder. They will have other options in there. You'll have to decide which ones you need. The first one is in the database that you're going to enable transparent data encryption, you want to create the master key. You want to create a certificate that's signed by the master key. The master key, actually, if you're interested, is protected by the DP API, the data protection API in the registry, so it's safe there. Then you create the database encryption key, and then you back up the certificate, because if you're going to want to restore your database somewhere else, you're going to need that certificate to be installed on the other server, and then you enable, it's alter database, enable, I think it's just enable encryption, and that will turn it on. One thing to note, may or may not be tested, but it's important to note, if you have any database that is using TDE, TempDB is going to be encrypted as well. So that's a side effect most people don't take into account, because any temporary objects that work with that database need to be encrypted, so TempDB is encrypted because we share it with everyone. You may or may not see some questions on the affinity mask. The affinity mask is really designed for your large iron boxes. You've got 64 cores, and you want to allocate certain cores to the OS, certain cores to instance one, certain cores to instance two. Also, the memory allocation, you will see questions about min server memory, max server memory, so make sure you're real comfortable with that, what it actually means, because the dynamic memory, while it may say the max server memory is 20 gig, if you haven't had that need, your max reported memory at that point may only be 10 gig. You know, what is it setting the min and max to the same value? What does that do for me? So just kind of the options around the memory. And I have a picture for the affinity mask. We'll go through that in a second. Database mail, again, it's an objective. You may or may not see anything on it. It's the removal of the old MAPI client to do mail and uses SMTP. So you have to enable an SMTP host, and you set that there. There's no profile needed, and then your alerts can fire off emails through a network-hosted SMTP server. So the affinity mask just says, for SQL Server, which of the processors that are presented to me do I want to use? The other way to do this is the Windows Server Resource Manager. So if you've got a big box and SQL is only one of the instances, you can use WSRM to say at the OS level, SQL will get these sets of sockets. Then within the SQL Server, you can say, I want this socket to be to handle all of my disk I/O. So you can do the processor affinity that way. Okay. Again, I wouldn't expect more than one question. This is a slide. Again, this deck was given to me to present, so I apologize. I wouldn't necessarily have done this to you. But essentially, it's a bit mask that says, of all the processors in a binary format, which ones are on, which ones are off. Use the UI. If you really are interested, then hit the script button. So if you want to look at, if you're not a UI person, you're a Transact SQL kind of guy or gal, then you can use spconfigure. The affinity mask is an advanced option, so you have to turn the advanced options on. So spconfigure, show advanced, one, reconfigure, go. Then do your SP configure and set your mask. That 38, if anybody wants to flip that in their mind in binary, that'll tell you exactly which of the processors are then allocated to SQL Server. Again, I wouldn't expect to see maybe one question on that. All right, SQL Server clustered instance. So this is interesting because there's two different things at play in SQL Server 2012. You can still do clustered SQL Server instances, but 2012 introduced the always-on availability groups, which are not clustered SQL Server, but they're on a cluster node. So when you're reading scenario-type questions, make sure you read it really carefully, okay? The availability group uses the FCI services for Heartbeat and Quorum, but does not require SQL Server to be clustered. In a clustered instance, the disk is shared among multiple nodes, and only one node has the SQL Server resources at any given time and can write to the disk. In the availability groups, it's shared nothing. Generally, each of your availability group replicas will have its own direct attached or network attached storage, and there's nothing shared. So that's the key difference there. What you do is you'll probably see some dialogues, but in the install, there's installing a standalone, and then there's installing a cluster instance. So you have to actually have the Windows cluster already installed, obviously, the virtual network name provisioned, make sure you have rights to add objects to Active Directory. If not, have your Active Directory administrator add the OU and the SPN for your new SQL Server instance in a clustered manner so that the virtual network name doesn't fail, which is a common one. And what you do is you install it. We went back, so for a while we had this join nodes to a cluster install. I think it was 2005, maybe it was 2008. And after a while, people were like, I got to do this install how many times? Now it's you just add nodes, you create you do the installation, and you can script it. So it's not the create the cluster, add nodes to the cluster, it's just install the clustered instance nodes. And it's all through that wizard. And if you've installed it, it's the same installing the second one. The only difference is if you're installing a second one, you can say, I want this joined to this cluster. The first one is where you set up the association with the cluster. Recover from a failed cluster node. I'm not really sure what we meant by this. If you have a failed cluster node, it fails over. And, you know. If it's hardware died, yeah. Well, then, yes. Okay, well, that's good. Thank you. I'm glad you came today. What you have to do at that point is you would stand up another node, join it to the Windows failover cluster, evict the node that had failed so that it's not in the preferred server list or preferred node list for the other nodes, and then reinstall SQL Server on the new node and then join that to the cluster. So the key is the eviction from the cluster before you add the new one and add the clustered SQL Server instance. Yes? Yes, you do. You're saying on the new node that you're going to join to the cluster. Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. It really doesn't matter, provided that if you're using server logins, not the user, just the user authentication, but you're still doing server logins, those logins have to exist on each of the availability group nodes. That's correct. If you do contain, then yes, you should be covered with that. All right. Install instances, obviously that's the wizard. Click, 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 click. Key things to look for, setting data directories, because otherwise it's all going to be on the C drive with your OS and everything. So when you get to, say, the SQL Server database, there'll be multiple tabs. There'll be the authentication. There'll be the data directories. There'll be the file stream tab. Make sure you go into the data and point that to a drive that is not your system drive. Again, we talked early on about the physical architecture of disks. Make sure your data is on one drive or LUN, and your log is on a separate set of spindles for performance. Resource governor is an interesting topic. because it's really hard to get your head around, because in most cases, the events that trigger resource governance don't occur on the large boxes. The concept is I set up work groups, and I classify users as they log into the server based on their workload. So if I'm an ad hoc user using ProClarity or some kind of business objects tool, I know that from the login information. And I put you in a work group pool that only is allowed to consume whatever you set it yourself, but say 40% CPU, 40% RAM. Now, if the RAM and the CPU get heavily loaded, then any connections that are in that work group pool will be constrained to use no more than 40%. But the way with these multiprocessor boxes, the fact that you hardly ever get all the CPUs 100% or at the load that would cause this to occur, it's hard to actually track the fact that things are being constrained. In 2014, we also added I/O as a part of the resource governor, which I think more people will now take care of and learn resource governor. Also, some of the workloads for the in-memory OLTP, the hackathon code, uses resource governor to classify workloads and prevent hackathon from over-consuming system memory. So the resource governor is where you use that. But basically, you create a login function, you create work groups, you assign resources, and then you have that classifier login function that assigns people based on their login information to a work group, which can then constrain their resource usage. So the key thing is classifier function. It's done at login time, so you don't want to be doing a lot of lookups. You really want to use the Nilotic functions like SUser sname, host name, application name if it's in the connection string, to quickly classify without having to go look up other information to classify, because it's going to affect your login and your connect times. Build list. What do we got here? Okay, so this again, this is something, I'm not going to force you to read this. These, again, you'll have these slides afterwards. You can go back through them. This is a TDE question. And like I said, that this is a case where the build list, what items do you use and what order do you put them in? Find the number of steps. This is a way to game it. If you don't know how many steps should be, just keep dragging things until it tells you you've got all you need. Now you know how many steps they're looking for. And then you got to figure out which ones are the right steps, and then you can put them in the correct order. So we got the correct number of steps, and those are the steps that are available. We don't need a credential, so we kind of throw that one out. And then once you got them, then you reorder them. So here, create a database encryption key, create the master key, the certificate, and enable encryption. So those are the kinds of things you can expect to see, excuse me, on a build list and reorder, because it really is important that you create the objects in the correct order. If you don't have a database master key, then you can't do the encryption of the database encryption key, the certificates, and so on and so forth. No, it isn't. I just noticed that. Master key is first. Yeah, you have to have the master key for your database. Then you create the database encryption key. Then you create the certificate enabler. Good. At least everybody's thinking, right? Yeah. So that's kind of the process, the mental process you go through with a build list and reorder. Probably spent more time on that than we needed, but. So deadlocks are something you'll probably see a question or two on. How do you identify them? There's certain trace flags you can use. The 1204 is the old 2000 style, hard to read report. The 1222 gives you the XML deadlock graph. You can also look for those events in SQL Server Profiler if you're profiling your application. And in 2012, there's absolutely no reason to use any of that. You use X events with the system health session, deadlocks are captured by default, and all you have to do is open the XEL files and you'll be able to see the details of your deadlocks. That won't be tested, but that's my gift to you. Understand there's only a few of the DMVs that you're really going to see on the exam. Tranlocks, OS weighting tasks, you may see weight stats, you may see exec query stats. But it's a small handful, and really what we're looking for is, in what instance would you go to that DMV to get information to help you optimize? So the system is slow. Thank you. So you would go to OS wait stats, right? See where the system is waiting. The waits and queues methodology, is everyone familiar with the waits and queues methodology white paper? You can get it up on MSDN. It was Ken Henderson that wrote it. It's just a structured approach for saying, okay, I walk up to a server and they tell me it's slow. I don't know if it's disk, I don't know if it's CPU, IO, I don't know if it's queries, it could be network. And it's a methodical approach where you look at the wait stats, see what you're waiting on. Once you've got that, you drill down into the queue that's waiting and then find the root cause from there. So it's called waits and queues methodology. Again, probably not going to be tested, but something I'd like you to know. Yeah, the system health session captures all of the system health. There's a stored procedure, SP, server diagnostics, that's called every 5 seconds. It looks at 5 main areas of SQL Server and reports on its health. So if memory is constrained, there'll be a report that says low memory. It's captured automatically. There's 4 files, they're 5 megabytes each, and they roll over. They have an XEL extension. They're in the log directory, wherever your log directory is, and that's where the deadlocks would also be captured by default. If you haven't worked with extended events, it's not going to affect you on the exam, but I highly recommend you start looking at extended events. Jonathan Cahias from SQL Skills did an excellent series. It was 30 days of extended events. Each day he blogged about a different way to use extended events. Profiler has been marked as deprecated, and the goal is to move everybody to extended events at some point in time. Now, that being said, will Profiler go away anytime soon? No. But the extended events are much, much more robust, and they give you a lot more information that you could never get from Profiler. For example, is everybody familiar with the term page splits? Right? So in the past, you could see page splits per second in Perfmon. But you had no idea, was that because we're adding pages at the end of a table? Or was it because we're tearing pages apart in the middle and moving stuff around? Extended events will let you examine that and help you decide what fill factor you should use to help reduce that fragmentation for the internal page splits and leave the other page splits alone. So I highly recommend it. Again, that's definitely something to look into as you move forward with SQL Server. Again, Profiler, Performance Monitor. These are things that most DBAs are fairly comfortable with. SQL Server Profiler obviously captures all of the traffic to a SQL Server. You can choose which events you want to capture, which details of information. Again, things that you'll see there will be things like, how do you specify the deadlock, XML deadlock graph in the profiler event? What would you choose? How would you monitor locks? How would you monitor the duration of transact SQL statements? So it's really the configuration. If you've used SQL Profiler and gone through that multi-grid dialogue, click and click, you'll be okay there. Performance monitor, understand, I must be running over again. Yep, I am. For performance monitor, know things like disk reads per second, disk writes, the latencies, page life expectancy, so how long you expect the pages to remain in the buffer pool, the cache hit ratio. So there's a small handful of ones that you should monitor anyway, and you should be doing that on a baseline. So when that goes out of whack, you know, okay, I've got a problem that's occurred. Extended events, like I said, they were introduced actually in 2008. Most people don't know that. 2008 R2 added some more, but it wasn't until 2012 that we gave you a first-class UI to deal with it. And in fact, If you're using a ring buffer for the destination for your extended events, you can watch the data live as it's flowing through the system. Very cool. The data collector is part of the management data warehouse. And what it does is it creates SQL agent jobs to do things like look at OS wait stats, the DM exec query stats, disk usage, CPU usage, and stores it in another database and gives you a set of reports to show you what your performance is like. Again, it's a very simple click-through wizard. You pick a server to put it on, and off it goes and it runs. There's not a lot of configuration. Just to understand, the data collector works with the management data warehouse. Let me see where we are in terms of getting done. Oh my. All right, we'll try to go a little faster. In terms of SQL Server, you can do policy-based management, which is in the management structure. You can do declarative. So you can say, I need to know whenever somebody creates a table that doesn't start with TBL, for example, and to reject that. That's policy-based management. It's declarative. You can set it up. You can take it and export it to multiple servers, so all your servers are managed the same way. You can do on-demand audits, like has the database been backed up in the last 7 days? Has a transaction log been performed? Basically, anything you can do with SQL management objects, the SMO interface or through the UI, is generally exposed as facets in policy-based management, and you can audit those kinds of things. Audit and audit specifications. So this is really been driven by compliance, things like Sarbanes-Oxley and those kinds of compliance where you have to be able to capture the information. In the past, you could do homegrown using triggers and whatnot and write to a table. There's a full infrastructure now that allows you to create audits, write them to a file. You can specify that if that file is full and can't be grown, shut SQL Server down because everything has to be audited. You actually can have the destination be off box. And the thing that the compliance brought to us is you can actually see the select statement and the data that the users have seen. So in the super high PII type hospitals and so on, they actually can use this to log, you know, this nurse viewed this patient's record, and they can see the select statement and the data that was returned. So we've got deadlocks. What do we do? I'd choose B myself, but the answer they're looking for is A. Right now, in the exam, if there's a choice between profiler and extended events, probably choose profiler. Oh, okay, A and B. All right, I didn't realize it was one of those tricky questions, all that apply. Yeah, so that's fine. Right. Understand what a differential backup does for you. Understand that it's a map of all the pages that have been changed since the last full backup, and because of that can actually be quite large. If you've got a database that is heavily transacted and a lot of the pages have changed, the differential can be almost as large as a full backup. The key is that it allows you to avoid intermediary log restores when you're trying to recover your database, because you do a full restore followed by the latest differential, which is all of the pages that have been changed since the last full backup, and then just do the log backup or log restores after that. So differentials will help you reduce recovery time, but it may not save you anything in terms of disk space. Point in time restore, the UI now makes it ridiculously simple. It has a slider, it tells you for the log and everything that you got selected, here's the times, and you just drag the thing out. I want to stop right there. So if somebody dropped a table at 9 p.m., you run your slider up to 8:59 p.m., restore the database, and the table's still there. So that's the UI version. Obviously, you can do that in Transact SQL as well. We talked about the file groups, using read-only file groups for historical data, having your primary file group just for your system objects, and have your user objects in a separate file group that can be backed up and restored independently. So if you're going to restore a database secured with TDE, you have to restore the certificate and recreate the key so that you can then have that cryptographic security there in order to decrypt the TDE to install it. It's one of the purposes of having TDE on a restore. If you have an issue, there is an option now where you can say on error, not on error continue, that's the old VB days, but it's something very similar to that. I can't remember the option, it's also a checkbox. But basically it says if there's an error, try to go ahead and restore the rest of the database for me, get as much of it as you can, and then it will take a page and mark it in MSDB and suspect pages table, and it will say for file 1, page 698 was suspect. You can then go to a previous backup and try to do a page level restore of that individual page. Obviously, it's not going to be transactionally consistent, but you can get some data there and try to recreate the data changes. So if it's a really important database, you got to get back online. As long as you have a page that's suspect, you're not going to get it back online. So you can do a page level restore. Some more of the DMVs you might use. The physical stats, DB index physical stats, will tell you whether or not your indexes are fragmented. Watch this one. Because all of the DMVs are only contain data since the last time the SQL Server service was started, they're in-memory items. You know, if you look at this and go, oh, I've got 12 indexes that haven't been used for anything, let's drop them. And then the CEO runs the end of year report and the server tanks. So the index usage stats, just kind of take that with a grain of salt. If you know it's been up for a long period of time, you've done all the workloads that you might need, then maintaining indexes for no reason is overhead that you don't need. But just make sure that you're not making blind decisions based on that. If you've used SQL Server Management Studio and done a query plan, you'll see the nice green text that pops up and says, hey, you got indexes that are missing. If you created this index, I could do 98% better on the query. Right click, and it gives you the query text. You create the index, life goes on. But there are DMVs that have that same information in them. If you don't want to do it interactively through the Management Studio query window. Again, we don't do this automatically for a reason. Sure, I could add 18 more indexes to this table and select performance would be great, but my insert update performance would be horrible. So it really requires a human to make that decision. Just know that these are the DMVs that you would look at, and it's a maximum of 500 entries per database. So the DMVs that start with DB are specific to an individual database. The ones that don't, that start with sys, DM exec or whatever, those are system-wide. So the DB ones, there's up to 500 of these missing indexes. And there's scripts out there that will read these and create the script to create the indexes for you. There's a lot of work been done around this. But just know what they're used for. So the concept of covering indexes, essentially, if you have a select statement with a projection, a column list that are being projected, and you have certain columns in the where clause, a covering index is a non-clustered index that has all the columns that participate in the where clause, as well as all the columns that are in your select list. If you have a covering index, it's a seek to get the data that you need, and it's very efficient. As opposed to if you do select star, we may use a non-clustered index to get to a row, but then we have to do a nested loop join to the clustered index to get the other columns. So one thing to do to cover your queries, in 2005, we introduced the include statement, where you can carry additional data elements along that would be in the select list without having them being part of the key of the non-clustered index. So covered queries or covering indexes are a performance improvement. There's other techniques, but that's what you're going to see on the test. Filtered indexes were introduced when we introduced sparse columns. They were designed to be applicable for sparse columns. So sparse columns is, I now have a table with 10,000 columns in it. For any given row, maybe 20 of them are filled in. So it was a storage mechanism, but then you could say, I want to create an index with a where clause. So where type equals camera. So now the index would only contain, in the B tree, would only contain the rows that correspond to the rows that have a type of camera. So when you do a query against that sparse table, we can use that index instead of a super large index that maybe has 10 million rows in it. But filtered indexes can be used independently of sparse columns. So let's say you have a print job table that has statuses in it, and you have pending status and you have completed status. And 90% of your rows are completed, and you just want to poll to find what jobs are out there. You could create a filtered index where status equals pending, and now you have a very tight index, and it will perform very well, and all of the historical data doesn't even get looked at. How are we doing? Oh, we're way over. Okay, I'll keep chugging along. We still got a lot of slides left. The recordings will be up there so you can get the stuff you missed afterwards. Please fill out an eval. I didn't even get to that slide. Column store indexes is something that was introduced in SQL 2012. And essentially, we take row-based storage and flip it on its head and instead store data by the column. It's kind of a bizarre concept, but let's say we're doing aggregation of large amounts of data. If we were to store all the data for a column together, then all the values that were similar would be together. It's very easy to run through and do aggregations. We're seeing 10 to 40% improvement on data warehouse loads where you can do a column store index. In 2012, it was only a non-clustered index, and the big downfall was you could not update the data in the table. So it was really do a nightly load, create the column store index, and get the performance gain. In 2014, you can now be clustered and it's updatable. So yet another improvement. Yeah, 2014. You won't be tested probably on the 2014 part. All right. I'll go as long as people stay, but I got to tell them that there's way too much. It was in 2012, but it was only non-clustered, and the table was not updatable. In 2014, it now can be updatable, and it also you can organize your table as a column store by clustering it with a clustered column store index. There's going to be very few questions on this, but how do you do data? Open row set, open query, bulk insert, the standard transact SQL items. So knowing the different roles, the capabilities, the server roles, the user-defined database roles, be comfortable with those, what they mean, and how you specify them, how you associate permissions with the security principles. And this is one, the principle of least privileges. You don't want to just make everybody a sysadmin. You know, put them in a role that's appropriate to what they're trying to do. So you may see a scenario that says we have users that are administrators, users that are operators, and users that are report runners. That kind of clues you that you should have multiple roles that will support those different operations. All right. So I didn't go through this just because I'm in terms of time. I want to get you guys through this. Always on availability groups, understand what it is, what are the requirements that the underlying nodes must be failover cluster instance nodes. You then have a non-clustered SQL Server instance on those nodes. Groups of databases participate as a unit in an availability group, so they're all kept up to date as a unit, and if the primary goes down, we fail over to the secondary. All of the databases are managed as a unit, unlike mirroring, where if you had, let's say, an HR and ERP, you had multiple databases that comprised your solution. Trying to manage that in a mirroring situation was a nightmare. Now they all move in a block. So you have six databases, they're all in a block, and they all are managed together. Know the difference in terms of performance by using synchronous versus asynchronous. Synchronous essentially says, I have to ensure that the transaction log on the replica has been written before I can commit the transaction. So think latency, especially if your secondary is across the country. Asynchronous says, I'm going to send the log block, and I'm going to assume that they wrote it, so the transaction commits quicker. So asynchronous is used a lot of times for disaster recovery or reporting that can be out of date by a couple seconds. So that's just some of the scenario-based things you might run into. Database mirroring is still in the product. It's been marked as deprecated. There may be one question in there. And again, if you understand availability groups, mirroring was the shoulders upon which the availability groups were built. Just understand high safety versus high performance, very similar to synchronous and asynchronous. High safety is equivalent to synchronous in availability groups. High performance is async. So you can kind of put those together. Replication, again, implement, create. You're not going to actually do the operation like we did in the MCM exams, but you're going to have to understand, I have three sites, that are going to be updating data simultaneously, and I need all of them to have an equivalent view of the data. Which type of replication should I use? That might be a question you'd see. So peer-to-peer replication, because you have multiple, anybody can write anywhere and they'll all converge. I have a set of salespersons that use their laptops and go to the field, and they're connected maybe once a week. And we eventually need the data to be consistent. What type of replication would you use? You'd use merge replication. So that's the kind of thing when it says implement, you're not going to actually be implementing it. This is just a nice study guide. It tells you the pros and cons of mirroring as opposed to the availability groups. Let you read this offline. I'm not going to. I'm just going through these. These again, you can. I hate to say it, but if you have some questions and they ask you the different technologies, and it says always on availability groups, it's probably a good choice. So the instructor-led training, if you are into that, it's a 5-day mock course. You can get it at CTEC. There is an exam prep video. There's some on Microsoft Virtual Academy that are free, and then they're pointed to also on the learning site. And then the practice tests, measure up. Like we said, we had Transcender upstairs. Self-test software also makes some practice exams. I recommend if you have the availability, if you have a little time today, at least go up and do the Transcender, get an idea of the feel. If you haven't taken a certification exam in a while, it'll let you see how the different item types operate and give you a feel for how you are. And I have to say, over the years, Transcender has been very, very close. If you can do well on the Transcender, you will probably do well on the actual certification exam. Believe it or not, we made it to the end. Training kit, highly recommend it. If you have it, I'll sign it. Born to Learn site, there's study groups. All right, now we get through all the other. The important stuff, you want an Xbox One, I'm sure. So submit your evaluation. I'll hang around. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them. Yes?
Do you